Welcome to the Mandy Trapp Podcast. My name is, of course, Mandy Trapp, and I am a busy mom of three, a mindfulness coach, and the founder of Lifestyle Meditation. I believe that all of us, whether you know it or not, are on a journey to find out who we are, why we're here, and how to get what we really want. But to know all of this, I know that we must get quiet enough to hear the answers. Sometimes these answers come from somewhere deep within ourselves, and other times we find the answers in listening to the stories of others. This podcast is all about taking you beyond the idle and sometimes distracting chatter of the mind and introducing you to new and creative ways of seeing the world, yourself, and even the problems that you face. Thank you for spending time with me today. Now let the experience begin. Hey everybody, and welcome to the very first episode of the Mandy Trapp Podcast. And I couldn't be more excited to have you here, but also to introduce to you a very dear friend of mine by the name of Cody Hodgson. Cody is a success coach. He's a lifestyle coach. He's a meditation teacher. Took all of his training through me at Lifestyle Meditation. He's an entrepreneur. He is a warrior. He is Indigenous, and he is a part of a local tribe here in Alberta, Canada. And he is a spiritual being that is living a very interesting human experience. He's one of the most courageous people that I know, and I am so excited that I have him as not only a mentor in my life, but my husband looks up to him, my boys look up to him, and he has not had an easy life. From his childhood that he's going to share with you in this podcast to becoming an entrepreneur, making millions, losing millions, and then coaching people really around what is the true meaning of success and of joy and of freedom. So please sit back, enjoy this podcast. We were live in the Lifestyle Meditation Studio on this day. So it's the first episode and the acoustics aren't fantastic for podcasts. They're great for chanting and for ceremony, but it's not fantastic for podcasts. But I'm sure you can put all of that aside to simply appreciate what is being shared by Cody and to see what part of yourself do you find in his story. So enjoy, my friends. Here we go. All right. Hi there, and welcome to the Mandy Trapp Podcast. I am Mandy Trapp, and today I have for my very first podcast episode, my very dear friend, Cody Hodgson. And Cody is here today to share quite a few things, to talk about love and life and loss and success and grief and really how do we find ourselves through all of these peaks and valleys that are in our lives and come back to who we really are, but also to connect to something that's maybe bigger than ourselves, our ancestry, maybe whatever this conversation is around collective spirit today. But I just wanted to take a moment to just say that Cody and I were supposed to meet a long time ago. And then he put it off, probably because he knew how awesome I really was. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah. As synchronicity would have it, we just met in the last few years here, and he's become my soul brother. And for that, I am deeply grateful. And probably just wanted to, we'll go right into it. I just wanted to say is, I noticed that in our culture, we sort of have these really weird preconceived notions around relationship, especially intersex relationship. And I'm married, and you're not married in a relationship, but I'm married in a relationship. Not yet. Maybe after this, you're going to find your magic mate. But I know that the love that I had for you wasn't this deep romantic love, but it was like, I knew you.
Yeah.
I think other people sometimes struggle with that. They're like, oh, you know, this is weird and I don't know what to do with that. But maybe we'll talk about that a little bit too at some point in this podcast. Maybe not, but I do love you and I'm so grateful that you're here.
Too.
You're like soul brother, soul brother and soul sister. So maybe if you just want to start, Cody, introduce yourself and share a little bit about your story.
Sure. So I'm born and raised on a small Indian reservation in Alberta. Didn't go too far. I currently live in Edmonton. I've been outside of the city back and forth. My story that I share as a life coach, as a presenter, as a meditation teacher, as a meditation student, I take people back to some of my challenges. I don't look at them as traumas anymore. I look at them as challenges in my life that has brought me to where I am now and leading this life of happiness and absolutely joy and love for myself. The first, I guess, preconceived notion of trauma in my life was when I was 6 and losing my dad to alcoholism. My dad was a product of the Canadian residential schools. At 6 years old, he was taken into the residential schools, and then he went through that process. At age 32, he died, and I was 6 years old myself.
And where were you when he passed? Did you see any of this go down? Or?
No, for years and years, I didn't know how he even died. Oh. There was no connection to my dad's side of the family. And then my mom's side of the family, when we lost our dad, he was the breadwinner. So for me, there was a huge connection there that I lost. And within about 2 weeks, from what I remember, I experienced my first sexual abuse incident that carried on for about three and a half years till I was about 9 and a half, 10 years old. Wow. And then after that, that first sexual abuse incident, I attempted suicide. At 6 years old. And I remember it was almost 2 weeks to the day that my dad died. Lost. My mom wasn't around. My mom was lost as well, in terms of her being a product of the residential school as well.
Yeah.
So for me, it was about having older siblings that didn't grow up with me, but I had these these two men that became mentors that I saw them as, but people that gave me love through sexual abuse. That's how I justified it. But at the same time, my spirit, knowing it was wrong, knowing that it was hurt and ultimately lost in life.
And so what were you looking for, or what were you looking to escape by trying to take your own life at 6? I can't imagine at 6, mm-hmm. even having the context that suicide is a possibility.
Yeah. For me, it was just the loss, the pain of not having my dad there, not having my mom there. She was searching for her purpose, searching for her love outside of herself as well. So the parenting wasn't there for me growing up. And because we grew up on the Indian reservation, we were in poverty. My siblings were forced to go out and marry as well at a young age, so they weren't around. So it was my youngest sister and I that were there. But again, due to poverty, she grew up with another friend of hers and their family. Thank God for them and that blessing. And then as we progressed, again, age 12, age 15 again, attempting suicide.
Again at 15.
Absolutely.
And was there some sort of event that triggered that, or do you feel that it was just like years of chronic struggling and stress?
For me, it was just ultimately finding where I belonged, having this just utter shame. Growing up in poverty, my mom married off the reserve. We lost our treaty rights. Treaty rights entitle us, technically, what people see, to housing rights, education rights, but we didn't have that. So I remember.
And then you lost them as a child because your mom chose to.
My mom married off, and we lost our treaty rights. She lost her treaty rights. So I remember it was about 2 or 3 years. We lived in this camper, one of these campers that you put in the back of a truck. We had one of those. So we lived in that throughout the winters, summers. Sometimes we didn't have propane. Sometimes we didn't have food. So that we didn't have power for lights. Mm. So living in that, so that just compounded the shame in terms of sexual abuse that was going on. Absolutely. As well as the suicide, and then going to school. That was, I always remember, and it chokes me up a little bit when I think back, and these, you know, I see kids with these lunches, and I was just in my head, I was like, wow, they're rich. They have all these, like,
they have great lunch. They have food. They're rich.
Like, they have all these, like, fruit roll-ups and, like, wagon wheels and all these, like, foods in plastics. And for me, it was like, I don't even have a lunch. But if I have a lunch, it's an apple and a piece of meat and bread and nothing even to put on the bread. And, you know, we couldn't even afford juice boxes. So for me, my thinking was, you know what, one day I'm never going to have to be in this. One day, and even as a young boy, I thought, you know what, I'm going to get out of this. Yeah. It was hurtful. It was a shame. It was shameful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So who were your mentors at that time in your life? Did you have somebody that you could lean on?
My mentors, I looked outside of the reserve. I looked at these people on TV. I looked at people that were doing really well.
Athletes.
I looked at politicians. I looked at people that were doing organic right. type stuff.
Right, to show you a different way. But as you are, you know, it's not politically right to say it anymore, but in that time you were this little Indian kid from the reserve, and yes. now you're looking at, you know, whoever you're looking, typically probably white people who yeah. are, you know, super financially successful or even in athletics. Did mm-hmm. you feel that that was possible for you, or did you have a belief, or were you fed a belief that that's great for them? I know that I want that, but that's not for people like me.
Yeah, for me, it was this mentality of that's not something I'll ever achieve.
Right.
I'm a native person, native kid, I'm on the reserve. It's something that people like me, Indian kids, we're not entitled to.
Right.
It's white people, like you say, it was that contrast of white people
yeah.
that that do those types of things. White people don't drink. White people don't do drugs, and
being they just do sometimes more expensive drugs,
yeah.
and they drink more expensive
yeah.
alcohol.
And I remember my first party I went to in high school, and my friends just happened to be, you know, a group of, you know, they were all white kids that were doing well. Yeah. One of them, her father was a super wealthy man, owned, you know, a professional sports team. And I remember going to their house for a party, and I thought, okay, like, what is this, you know, what is this party? It was middle yeah. of winter. They lived in West Edmonton. And we went there and I saw for the first time white people drinking. And I was absolutely shocked.
Oh my gosh.
I saw white people intoxicated and I was shocked. So I made an excuse because I didn't know how to deal with that. I was
yeah.
absolutely shocked.
So what'd you do?
So I walked home. I put my coat on.
What? How long was that walk?
It was about 2 hours in the middle of winter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know how far the reserve is mm-hmm. from that.
So I walked home and it was all about me going home and just being at home. And I remember as soon as I got home, 15 years old, I just broke down and started crying.
Yeah.
Because I was so shocked.
Yeah.
And I thought these people I could look up to, they were my mentors. And I didn't, yeah. even though I didn't tell them that, it was more disappointment. It wasn't about the shock of seeing them drinking.
Absolutely.
It was the disappointment that I thought, you know what, where do I go now? So for
Absolutely.
Me, it was always finding these mentors
yeah.
of people that, okay, I can model my life after these people. I'm going to mimic them. I got very good at copying people and
yeah.
sitting back and watching people and saying, okay, this is what you do to be successful.
Yeah.
This is what you say to be successful. This is how you act. This is how you stand up.
Right.
This is how you dress to be successful.
So definitely finding that outside of yourself. It's so funny that you say that, because in an interesting way, it reminds me of the story of the Buddha.
Mm-hmm.
Right, where, I mean, the Buddha was a real person. He was a prince,
yes.
right, in India, and his parents were the king and the queen of the kingdom. And the difference was is that he didn't see suffering. He didn't have a life of suffering until he was 13 years old. You had a life of suffering,
mm-hmm.
but you were looking at something outside of yourself. But where I see the similarity in this was the day that he actually jumped those palace walls and he got outside into the outside world and saw death, and he saw illness, and he saw people aging and writhing in pain and anger, and
mm-hmm.
that I can't imagine, like, especially in this day and age. This wasn't like in the 1800s.
Yes.
This was
yes.
like 25 years ago, right, for you, or whatever
mm-hmm.
that is, maybe
yeah.
almost 30 years ago for you.
Yeah.
This is in like today's modern culture, that it shows how isolated sometimes and how segregated people are when we take them outside of
mm-hmm.
the rest of society, and we
yeah.
put them into isolation. We put them on the reserves, or we just basically segregate them, or we
yeah.
take them out. And what it is that we're seeing outside of ourselves is it's not always what's true.
Yeah.
Kind of
yeah.
like social media.
Yes.
Right? Is that everybody lives these beautiful lives.
Yeah.
And then you really get to go and hang out with somebody and it starts to mess us up. We're like, what the hell?
Yeah.
Right? But it causes us to go back into ourselves and to go, what do I really believe now? Because what I believe to be true is not necessarily true.
Yeah. And what else people are practicing. Like for me, I held on to my my indigenous practices that I was taught as a boy
all the
from
way
my
through.
Grandmother. Kukum always, you know, taught us how to smudge. We went to ceremonies. and those held true to me until I started going to high school in Edmonton, where people said, "Oh, you know, I was the type of person that if you were Native, you could see the Native in me, but at the same time, I could identify with Caucasian or different cultures just because of the way my skin color was, my height, my look." And some people didn't realize I was Native.
Yeah.
And, you know, I realized the racism was prevalent in high school. Right. People would say, "Oh, this Native person did this Native person did that." And for me, it made me crumple with shame even more. It's like, okay, I don't want these ceremonies. Well, who do I identify with? Right. Do I protect myself? Do I say, okay, just pretend to laugh and have this uncomfortable laugh where it's like, I'm Native, that's me.
Yeah.
And it's like, I'm not worth anything. So struggling with this worthiness all the way through of like, okay, finally, where are things going to end?
Yeah.
And that's where, in my teens, it's like, I'm not worth anything. I'm shameful. It wasn't about.
So you attempted suicide a third time.
Yeah. It wasn't about.
Like, if nothing tells you that you're supposed to be here.
Yeah.
More than the fact that it didn't work those three times.
And each time I went to that same tree on the reserve, and that tree, the reason I went there, because I remember seeing that tree where these men took me to all the time when they came to my house. And at the time, they were in their teens, and one of them was a young man. And we'd walk by that tree every time. And that was that tree that I walked by. And I went back to that tree. Every time I was sexually abused, we walked by that tree. And I was like, okay, I'm going to go by this tree. Oh, third time I went to that tree, again, each time it broke. But it was because just that internal pain, it was spiritual pain, it was emotional pain. It wasn't physical pain.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what was your way out of that? Did you, well, I know you, so maybe you just share this. I know this, but maybe can you share with everybody what helped you to get out of that?
For me, at a young age, I identified with a lot of motivational people. And again, there was massive shame around that as well when I was a young kid, because it was embarrassing. People were like, "Oh, who's this Tony Robbins guy?" I remember high school meeting Tony Robbins in my head. I was like, you know, I saw him on a video. I was like, holy shit, this guy is cool. This is exactly what I want to do. I want to be at the time, a motivational speaker. I want to be able to help people. I want to get people energized.
Right.
So for me, having that dream, but as well, when I went to high school, realizing going in the weight room for the first time and actually having a program and a high school coach that cared about me, that didn't identify me as a Native kid, suicidal, sexually abused, less shameful, embarrassed, you know, degrading, anything like that. He saw my athletic capability.
Mm-hmm.
And so for somebody to see that value in me, made me say, okay, I want to do this. I want to do these things, but not knowing how to put dreams together, not knowing how to connect my goals. It was like, one day I'm going to do this. One day I'm going to do this, but wanting this massive, massive amount of freedom.
Right.
And I didn't know what that looked like.
No, which I have to just say, though, like, of all the research that's done on people who are the most resilient people, so not only the ability to be able to bounce back from stress, but to be able to come out of something that is very traumatic, to find and to seek the opportunity in it and use it as a catapult, right? Or almost like something to stand on to take to the next level, which I've watched you do time and time again. But the number one trait that they all share is that they had a mentor. They had somebody that believed in them, which is why I ask you that question.
Yeah.
Because I know that he was that for you. He didn't do the work for you,
mm-hmm.
but he definitely opened the door and encouraged you to walk through again and again.
Yeah.
And it was that got you out of there. So where did you end up going?
Well, you know, and obviously high school and then university, and one of the other big mentors was my mom, even though she wasn't there. I remember going to hockey tournaments in California, track and field meets, and she literally, everything was paid for. Yeah. It was like, you know what, here's $5. Like, I'm going for 10 days, that's all you have is $5?
Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah.
But it's looking back, I hung on to that $5 because when I went away from the reserve, when I went away from my family, I was so lonely, so homesick. And that by piece of paper with $5 written on it represented my home, represented love. And at the time, I didn't identify it as love. I didn't identify it as comfort. But I remember waking up at track meets, hockey games in the middle of the night, crying. And just like, oh, I wish I could just, I just want to go home. I know I'm going to be home in 5 days. I just want to go home. I don't want to be here. And, but just looking at, I learned, you know what, I'm going to take a pillow. I'm going to take something from home that smells like home. And it just reminded me to come back.
Yeah.
It was like, yeah, I'm going to be back. But it was comfort. And just in that comfort of always, you know, there was this desire to say, okay, where's my comfort? Once I have that comfort, then it's, you know, when I have massive capability, and it's like, do well in hockey, do well in track. And then that carried me forward into going into policing and realizing the reason I went into policing was because seeing my mom's ex-husband beat her up emotionally, physically, spiritually, everything. Yeah. My goal was to go into policing and then to kill him, and then also to kill the two men that, that sexually abused me.
So how'd that work out for you?
It worked out well. I got out of policing and realized, you know what, policing sucked.
And well, and that's not the right, it's not the right reason to go into it.
Yeah.
Right. It's not the right reason to, but I mean, obviously your motivation was there, right?
Yes.
It's like, if I can continue to not control all of these things happening to me or people that I love, then I need to find a way to be able to control that.
Yeah. And then
to take care of that.
That's, you know, when I started my first company, a security company, and realizing the value of, wow, I can make money. I can make a lot of money.
Yeah.
At the same time, having a company, it was about scarcity.
Yeah.
It was still in that scarcity mentality of, wow.
What if, but can I just say something really quickly that I've never thought about, that it's funny that you went from policing to security. Because when I hear you now say that your primary motivator to go into policing was to kill your mom's husband and the men that had sexually abused you, is that's like a power move. It's like me going in to just take something down.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
But the security piece is about stepping back and just protecting what's there.
Protecting, and then the other part, what I guess resonated with me was the customer service. Realizing that, holy cow, these people actually, aside from being a paid service, I'm offering them kindness. And that's really where my kindness and love really started to show, because the work I did for these people, it resonated in a point of not just doing the work, like I actually care about these people. So like talking to these people, and you know, they pay good money, but it was customer service in terms of, you know, actually learning how to recognize people's feelings and say, you know what, how are you doing today? Okay, this is what we're doing. And because they're giving me full control to run their lives and dictate, okay, we're doing this and this and this for your safety, for your security.
But interesting, so to keep people safe. So the fact that safety, so physical, mental, emotional, financial safety, all of the other ways that we feel safe, that is like the fundamental need that we all have as human beings.
Yeah.
So here you were there, like protecting, let's just say, their physical safety. But like you said, going into this as a business for you was all about securing your financial safety.
Yes. Yeah.
Right? So, I mean, you're both playing different roles within that, except at the same time, you're both coming from such a vulnerable place of trying to ensure safety and security.
Yeah. So it was, it was like, my clients, the principals, we were on that same level.
Yeah.
So we could, realizing, looking back on an energetic level, we connected. And that's why I think it worked so well. And that's why I was so successful. And the people that I worked with was, you know, having these people that would come out to me like, you know what, you're a great person. You're kind. Mm-hmm. You're this, you're this, you're this. But it went in one ear and out the other. It was a microsecond. I was like, yeah, thanks.
You didn't hear it or absorb it.
No.
Because what was still playing there for you?
It was all those old tapes of you're native. You suck. You know, you're shameful. You're embarrassing. You're hiding. Like I didn't tell anybody about my sexual abuse until I was 35 years old. So I hung on to that for 29 years. And just continued to pretend things were great.
So are the people that abused you still alive?
One of them is still alive.
Yeah.
And years ago, I accepted it for what it was.
Yeah.
And I forgave them. I pray for them all the time.
Yeah.
And I'm grateful for that challenge they put me through.
Right.
Because, like I said, I wouldn't have the life I have right now if I didn't go through those challenges. I don't see them as traumas anymore.
Yeah.
I fully accept, and I don't blame anymore either. It's just challenges that have brought me to where I am, to realizing my goal.
And so where has it brought you? Where are you today?
I'm with yourself taking your 200-hour course a few years ago. That there was just, it just locked and loaded me right into alignment of where I need to be. Like my grandparents telling me these spiritual teachings, these practices you have, one day you use them, Cody. And I always pushed them away because it brought me back to this impoverished mentality where now mainstream, those smudging, those practices, it's about teaching people and sharing those healing practices that we have. So for me, I'm a life coach. I'm a speaker. I'm a presenter. I'm a meditation teacher. I'm this person that understands energy now, that understands these spiritual practices and where they fit into my life.
Right. So I have a question for you about that.
Sure.
Because, I mean, since I've known you and we've become close in the last few years, is that I've only ever known you as somebody who's like deeply spiritual.
Yes.
But in terms of the sadhana, in terms of the practice of spirituality, is that you are practicing through your ancestry, through your indigenous ancestry. And there, of course, are practices and protocols that are there. And I know that you went away from it and you came back for all of those reasons. You and I have talked like intimately about such in our culture in today's day and age, there's so many people that struggle and they suffer, not unlike how you did as well, because of this disconnect from spirit and practice.
Yeah.
And what I have to say from my perspective where I sit is I don't know what my ancestry is, right? Like my mom is from Poland and my dad is from England and from Scotland. And there's not anything that has been shared with, you know, my parents, with my grandparents or great grandparents in terms of this is how you get closer to God or this is how you learn who you are. And so what I found for me is that you can call it reaching or grasping for other traditions, if you will, but I'm not alone in that. There's a lot of people that are trying to do that right now. And I think what I notice as a bit of sensitivity or a tenderness is that, you know, people that I speak to, they're like, yeah, I want to smudge. I want to chant mantra. I want to do this, but I also don't want to be disrespectful, right? I don't want to, you know, I don't know, I've been accused of all of this cultural inappropriation or cultural appropriation before. but I can't even say it right. And I'm laughing about it and I shouldn't be, but it's very real because I'm so blessed to be invited by your mushroom and your kukum to sweats and to ceremony. And I've been gifted that eagle feather that I cry every time I look at it and really honored just as spirit and that we walk together. But I think that there's still a huge misunderstanding for other people that want to be closer, but they don't know how and they don't want to offend. Can you just speak to that?
Absolutely. The way I was raised as a boy, a young boy, in our cultural practices, those in some of our cultural practices, we sing these songs. Songs have been handed down to us generations, hundreds and hundreds of years old. And the way I was taught was those songs, there's resonance in them. There's healing in those songs. That's why we sing those songs. We always, you know, I've always been taught as a boy, we share that healing. That healing isn't just for our family. In those practices, in our sweat lodge ceremony, in our sun dance ceremony, our horse dance ceremony, it's celebrating our family, but it's also celebrating our practices. And we've always honored anybody that has been wanting to learn. We've never ever shunned anybody away or said this is the wrong way. This is the wrong way. If somebody, if we've been taught a certain way, we teach you how to do that.
Yeah.
And we've never ever accused anybody of stealing our ways. We share our ways with people because it's about carrying on to those generations and healing. So we look at when you were at the lodge, you know, my mushroom, my cook'em, they tell me things that repetitively I've heard as a little boy. But the whole point in that practice is so we remember.
Right.
So we remember that. And it's the healing in that. So when people come, I can share that as well.
Right.
But when I share that, there's that, it comes from our heart, it comes from our spirit,
from heart and I think integrity, right?
Yes.
Which is why there's protocol. But what my experience has been, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that any time that a lot of offense has been taken is because there's been just little bits and pieces that have been taken from this mm-hmm. book or from this teaching or from this lesson.
Yes.
And it's not that you're not doing it right or you're not in protocol, but just to stay in integrity and make sure that it's heart-based.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
That, I mean, I love this, and I think maybe that's what we can encourage other people is if you're genuinely interested is to mm-hmm. reach out
absolutely
to the elders in your area or to other, you know, indigenous people that you know that are mm-hmm. deeply into these practices.
Yeah.
Because it is a warm and welcoming environment where I believe, and I know you believe, that the majority of indigenous peoples want to share
yes.
their practices. But there could also be, and I've experienced this as well, there could also be that barrier, that hang up, because for so many years they weren't allowed.
That's
and
right.
not only were they persecuted, but they were killed for sharing mm-hmm. that too. So maybe with a yeah. little bit of sensitivity, if somebody shuts you down, you know, as a non-Indigenous person, yes. you say, I want to learn this, and somebody says, no, you're not allowed, it's a protection mechanism. It's back to that safety piece.
It's generational, yeah.
It's generational.
When we were put on the Indian reserves, we were given a monthly stipend. We had an Indian agent that checked in with us. We right. weren't allowed off the reservations if we were.
Yeah.
We got permission from this Indian agent. If we went off or if we practiced certain cultural practices, we were put in jail. So right. that's why the reasoning is all these practices went underground, so it was protected.
Yeah.
So it's generational where there's, you know, I see on social media sometimes where people are speaking out and saying, well, those are our practices, you're not doing it right.
Yeah.
But for our family and context, it's I'm not saying those people are right or wrong. We teach people and we encourage people to reach out. Like I'm, like you say, I'm deeply enmeshed in our spiritual practices.
Yeah.
And I encourage people as well, if they have questions, there's people that have asked me questions and
yeah.
they're awkward about it. And I say, you know, you don't need to be awkward about it. Oh, absolutely, I'll share with you. And then if they want medicines that we have, I teach them what our protocol is
absolutely.
In terms of tobacco, making offerings, and then how do you pray with those
yeah.
medicines to my best ability.
Which is so amazing. It's just who you are and you're bringing it into the world of coaching and leadership. And mm-hmm. guidance, and I feel like we could keep talking about this forever, and let's do
yeah.
a part two. But where can people follow you on social media?
So Instagram, I have Cody Hodgson Coaching, and then also on Facebook as well, it's Cody Hodgson Coaching.
Okay, that's easy.
Yeah.
Or in Snapchat, can
yeah.
some of the girls snap you? No, I heard the other day only people under 22 use yeah. Snapchat.
And then yeah, the website, I'll be launching the website soon.
Yeah.
And then I'm also in March going to be opening up a conversation around just men, getting men talking, but women are also allowed in yeah. this forum. So in March, I'm going to just start talking to men and reaching out to more men.
So let's do a part two all about men.
Sure, absolutely.
That work?
Absolutely.
Okay. And then we'll bring you back on the show again. I'm so grateful. I could
Thank
cry
you so
right
much,
now.
Man.
I'm so grateful that you're the big launch of this podcast because your story is so true and it's so authentic. And I think it sets the tone for everything mm-hmm. that's important to me to be able to share with people.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you
I
so much.
I love you.
Love you.